The Science of Safety Online, brought to you by the Online Safety Exchange. I'm Martin Cocker, and this is Radio SOSA.
Laura Higgins, welcome to the Online Safety Exchange podcast, also known as Radio SOSO, the Science of Safety Online. And I just wanted to chuck you straight in the deep end if I could. Just imagine that you left Roblox. I know that's hard to imagine, but you left Roblox and you've been given a position as the senior everything of trust and safety of a brand new but highly successful, fast-growing social media outlet. And you say to the people who have just employed you, you know, what have we got in place in terms of safety? And they say, they just look at you and they say, you. So what do you do? What's your first thoughts? Where do you start?
You know, one of the things that I've sort of learned over the years is that you need to have a real multi-layered approach to these things. There's not one tool that does everything. So I think first would be, you know, just to double check, do an audit to make sure they didn't have anything in place. But assuming that they didn't, I think it would be about putting some things in just as an absolute basic. So, you know, having filtering in place, using the safety tech tools that are out there, making sure that there was the ability for users to be able to report and block and all of those basic things, building out both the technology behind that, but also human moderators, which I just think is always going to be an essential need. Computers can't make those rational decisions on some of these tricky topics. Then I think spending time in the community, finding out what sort of platform it is, what the issues are, what the historic issues have been. And then you can become a bit more nuanced, I think, about your approach to safety and what might be needed for different platforms. Definitely having safety partners is really important, I think. So I would be looking to who the right NGOs and sort of charities in the online safety space and the parenting space or you know, other support networks, and making sure that the community have access to that as well. Having good advisors would probably help in steering the policy side of things, which would be my next thing, which is, you know, making sure that there were really clear community standards and good policies in place, as well as, because actually moderators can't do their job if you don't have the rules to begin with. So, you know, being very clear for the community what the expectations are, but then also for the moderators so that they can support the community best, I think, and then just keep building it from there. You know, these are really iterative processes. You can't kind of do a one and done. So I think it's just a case of keeping an eye on the health of the community and then adding things as you go along.
Well, it sounds like you've really got a handle on it. In fact, if anybody's listening and they are running a highly successful, fast-growing social media system and they haven't got a safety team in place, I'm sure they'll give you a call. How did you get here? So you're currently the Director of Community Safety and Digital Civility at Roblox, or some variation of those, because it seems to be written different at different places, but those two things. So community safety and civility, you know, I guess let's start with, what does that mean? So what is your job at Roblox?
So I'm actually the senior director.
Of course.
And it is. Apologies. Yes, it is indeed. So senior director of community safety and civility. So The community safety piece is quite broad. It is around, you know, we have three pillars that we work towards. So it is about partnerships, it is education and research predominantly. So I work with safety organizations, parents, governments, law enforcement, you name it, educators, to have kind of keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening out there in the community. So they might talk to me about particular trends that they're seeing in the country that they're based in, which might be very different things that are affecting kids in the US or the UK, where I'm based. So that's a really helpful thing. And it's a reciprocal relationship with those partners. So we will also keep them abreast of updates coming onto the platform, you know, if we're rolling out a new policy or there's a new tool that's coming out for the community. And they help us to amplify those messages so that they do get them in front of those teachers and parents and everybody that needs to know. And again, you know, having that kind of global network of partners is really helpful. We create resources and do projects with those partners as well. So, for example, media literacy is a hugely important area of my work. But, you know, there are certain things I can talk about. And obviously, I create resources that are about how to stay safe on Roblox and broadly about online safety. But sometimes we might do a specialist project. For example, we're working on one at the moment about neurodiverse kids who might have additional support needs, but I'm not an expert in that. So we're looking to partner with both some parenting organisations and also some organisations who are experts in that particular field of kind of kids with autism, etc. And then the research piece is both internal and external. So we have our own team in-house who do pulse surveys and different bits of research, and sometimes that's on the platform level and sometimes it is about reaching out to the community. But we also work with other organizations and academics and colleges and universities all over the world on lots of different types of topics, and then we use that to actually inform our practice in-house. So we feed that back to the product and safety teams, for example, to help them to make positive decisions that are going to have a good impact on the community. What? A lot of public speaking.
What is Roblox? I mean, for people who don't have kids or at the age, you know, where they're really into Roblox, they might not actually really even know what it is or what makes it different from any other kind of game or gaming platform or whatever. Can you kind of just, in a nutshell, describe what Roblox is?
Yeah, so Roblox's vision is to sort of reimagine the way that people come together. So it is a platform with many, many different games and experiences, all created by our network of young developers and creators all over the world. So they create these different experiences and then other people can come and hang out in those. And some of them are quite traditional game style things that you would see on other platforms. Some of them are role play, for example, and then some of them are just much more social experiences, places where kids will just go and hang out together, just like they would in the real world. They might share some missions, it might be a social thing, there might be entertainment, they might be watching their favorite pop artist, for example, doing a performance, or watching, you know, a film together. Those sorts of things will all happen within the platform. Because it is all user generated, there is also that creator element. So anybody can learn very basic skills and how to create those games and experiences themselves as well, using something called Roblox Studio. But yeah, we have about 66 million daily active users, so it is very popular.
It's just kids having fun online. So, you know, I mean, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, the average age of a Roblox user is, I'm going to just take a stab at like 12, 13. Is that like the average age, or is that too young? Am I pitching it a bit young?
No, so we have a really broad range of ages. I think traditionally we were seen as a platform for younger kids, and certainly we have a lot of people on the platform who are that kind of at 9 and 10. Yep. But we over half the people on the platform are now 13 and over. And actually, our fastest growing age group is 17 to 24, which is really interesting. And those people are quite often people who maybe had come onto Roblox when they were a younger kid, had a little dabble, played around on it, and then they've come back when they're a bit older, either to create those experiences because they're interested in game design or whatever, or also just a bit of nostalgia, and they just come back and they're still hanging out with their friends on the platform as well as creating. So
what does go wrong on Roblox? I mean, you know, what are the kind of main safety issues that you deal with and try to manage on that platform?
I mean, it's the same sort of issues that will be anywhere where there are kids interacting online. So obviously we have a lot of tools in place. We very much take a preventative kind of approach to these things. We are very much a safety by design sort of model. So in the past, we've actually had criticism from kids that were a little bit too restrictive. So, for example, we have really, really strict chat filters, particularly for the younger kids on the platform. So they could, you know, for some time, they couldn't actually share numbers because we're trying to prevent them from sharing personal information. So they couldn't share phone numbers or addresses, etc. But actually, if they were playing a game, for example, you know, work in a pizza place, and they wanted to say, hey, I sold 3 pizzas today, they wouldn't actually be able to do that. Things have moved on. Technology's got a lot more sophisticated. So now we can pick up the signals of whether it is in the context of selling 3 pizzas or whether they're trying to give out their phone number. So we're a lot more intuitive with those sorts of things. But yeah, so it is about sort of teaching and educating the community that they are in a social space, that they could be interacting with people that they don't know, and that there are inherent risks with that. So we try to prevent as much as possible. But yeah, so, you know, trying to get kids not to share personal information, to not go off platform, you know, if somebody's acting strange, to know that they can take control and that they can report it, and that, you know, trusting that we will take action on that. But because of the demographic, I think we do see, you know, as you would expect, sort of kids falling out, being mean to each other. So yeah, just trying to help empower the community to stay healthy and not get involved in sort of bullying behaviours and things like that. Of course, we have tools so that they can report any of those behaviours to us. And of course, you know, the biggest thing, I suppose, is us being a user-generated platform, is that particularly when the kids get to kind of mid-teens and they want to be a little bit disruptive, they might try to create something that looks rude or isn't really appropriate for the platform.
I can't possibly imagine. That didn't happen when I was there.
Precisely. So yeah, so we pre-moderate content before they're allowed to sort of launch it onto the platform. So we review audio and video files and things like that before they're allowed on there.
You mentioned safety by design. You're a safety by design. You take a safety by design approach. My Trans-Tasman neighbours, the eSafety Commissioner's Office, has a particular safety by design model. Do you follow someone's model, or did you develop your own? Like, how did you approach safety by design?
So platform itself actually has quite a long and interesting history. It actually started out as a physics app that was used in classrooms, in schools, where kids could carry out experiments, physics experiments that they couldn't do in the real world. So things like, you know, learning about velocity, what would happen if you pushed a car off the top of a skyscraper. You're not going to be able to do that in the real world, but you could do it with this creation model that they'd built. Yeah. So it was always built as a tool for kids, to be used by kids in a classroom environment. And I think that evolution then into becoming Roblox, that mindset of this is about kids, being built for kids, it was automatically there. Safety was kind of there right from day dot. It wasn't something that was added afterwards as an afterthought. I think, you know, it's one thing I talk about quite often, that it's very difficult to retrofit safety. It's like once you started having those problems on the platform, it's hard to kind of counter them and get, you know, put the genie back in the bottle, as it were. So it's much better to start small, be very iterative, and really being creative as well. So that basis, as I say, of those really strict filters, for example, and having really clear code of conduct and sticking with it, being really, you know, a little overly cautious at times, then yes, you know, once you have better tools and time goes on, then you can sort of relax a little bit with the older ones and whatever's appropriate. But also you still have to be innovating. So being prepared to be agile, not just sit on your laurels and say, hey, we're safe, we've got these tools in place, but always looking for the next thing that's going to, you know, make the platform even more safer and prevent more harm.
When I first met you, you worked for the Southwest Grid for Learning. How did you end up in Southwest Grid doing online safety? Did you fall into it? Was online safety something you're interested in before you went there? I mean, how did you get there?
So I've worked in safeguarding in one form or another pretty much all of my career. Right. So it used to be real world safeguarding. So I worked for the probation service. I've run homeless outreach services. I've run drugs and alcohol services. My husband jokingly used to say I was a do-gooder in a good way. But yeah, so that was always in me. And a huge part of that and my responsibility often was around child protection. So I'd, you know, I've done lots and lots of training and things specific in that area. Then I became a committee member for one of the biggest grant making charities here in the UK, which is the BBC Children in Need organisation. And I was a committee member there for 3 years, helping deliver grants to charity to children's charities. And at that time, I think there was just a real growth in, you know, internet. Apps were starting to become popular. Some of these websites that we now take for granted, they were just kind of in their infancy at that time. And what we realized is that there was no media literacy, digital literacy. Kids were kind of just given this opportunity, go forth, you know, do whatever you want on the internet. Nobody understood it. And a lot of the adults around them were really confused and just didn't want to know. And so when we started having discussions about, you know, policy and where duty of care would be when children were online. So that was already starting to creep into my day-to-day job. Fast forward ages, just saw this job advertised, which they actually were looking for somebody either from an education background or a social work background, which is kind of where I was coming from. Yeah. And the role was to set up a helpline for schools specifically, but also anyone with a duty of care for kids to help them manage online and digital safeguarding issues, to run a pilot for 12 months and then just evaluate it regardless of whether it was successful or not. So it was a real pilot kind of project. Didn't think for a second I'd actually get it. And yeah, fast forward, you know, I was there for 9 years. So clearly I did quite well.
Yeah. Or they just simply couldn't find a way to get rid of you. One of those two options.
Bit of that too.
I'm sure that's not the case. So there was a helpline that had a name like Boss or Posh or something like that. So there was a professional services helpline. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was the one I set up. So yeah. I literally came in, it didn't exist. So from day one, it was like, what would a helpline look like? You know, what are the policies? What are the rules? How are we going to advertise it and recruiting staff? But yeah, it was the Professionals Online Safety Helpline. So it does what it says on the tin. So it was for anyone, as I say, with a duty of care for kids. We didn't know what topics people might call us about. We didn't know what they were facing in schools. We didn't even know whether anyone would ever ring us. So we just sort of sat there on the day we launched and, you know, yes. After a couple of prank calls from my colleagues, of course, who thought that was hilarious. But yeah, you know, people just started contacting us and it was a little bit of finding our way at first about what advice people needed and what the issues were they were facing. And then very quickly, we kind of realized that we needed to get partnerships with the tech companies, and that would be the key of being able to resolve some of these issues. So we kind of had conversations with the likes of Microsoft and Google, and then later Facebook, and they were all very supportive, you know, agreed that what is now actually referred to as trusted flagger programs, which is quite commonplace everywhere. I think we were one of the first to have that relationship where we had a dedicated person that we could just sort of email and ask questions and they would help us to resolve some of these issues, and it just went from there.
Yeah, we're talking about 2013, 2014, it's 10 years ago, and 10 years doesn't sound that long, but that was really sort of the pioneering days of a lot of those help desk services, and you know, you would have been one of the few help desks of the type in the world. And then, of course, you went from that experience to the revenge porn helpline, and that really was pushing the boat out. I mean, I don't know who you went to talk to at the time about what they were doing in the space, but there wouldn't have been too many people with experience doing something similar. So can we just talk about that experience? You know, what was the genesis of that? We should start with the obvious question that a lot of experts would say is like, why is it called the Revenge Porn Helpline when we're not supposed to say revenge porn? And then maybe we could, so let's start with that. Why did you call it the Revenge Porn Helpline?
Well, let's start with my original helpline. I actually launched in February 2011. So it went back even further than that. It really was very, very new at the time. The reason that we actually launched the RP helpline, and we'll come on to your question about why the name. The reason that we launched that is because we were receiving cases on the other helpline from teachers who were being targeted and harassed, threatened with people exposing their personal images, intimate sexual images online, and actually several people who had been exposed, and the content was, you know, shared broadly. Obviously, if you're a person in a position of trust like that in a school environment, not only are you a victim and it's extremely damaging, but actually the impact on the school and potentially pupils seeing it, all of those sorts of issues. And so we had a couple of these cases and it was, you know, really difficult. We had to unpick our way of having content removed, trying to then backtrack and find where these pictures might be and also support the victims and the school at the same time. But then it wasn't just once or twice. It was like once we got to like 6, 7, 8 of these cases happening, and it seemed to be increasing as a trend pretty quickly. So I started talking about it, you know, in the media and just sort of flagging that this was a potential issue. We'd spoken at events about it. And then people just started contacting us saying, actually, this has happened to me too. There's nowhere to go for help. Can you help us? And so from about 2013, we were the only people in the UK who were sort of dealing with this. And then we were getting referrals from not teachers or not professionals, but just people who were just desperate and really needed our help. So I kind of became the country's expert on this topic. At the time, there were just starting to be cases in the media. So there wasn't a name for it. You know, we were actually referring to it as image-based harassment, which I think is actually pretty close to what it is. But that would not be a particularly helpful name to describe it elsewhere. And the media was starting to see particularly celebrity cases where somebody was being, you know, had had their intimate images posted online and they had coined the term revenge porn. We found it really problematic. And when we would sort of fast forward to, I think we need a dedicated service to support victims of this. So, you know, I was having meetings with the government trying to source funding for the topic. And actually at the time, the government were quite keen that we keep that term because it was something that was recognisable, that people, it was like a term that people were getting used to. But even having the word porn in the title of our helpline made it very difficult. It was blacklisted in certain places because people assumed it was actually the opposite of what we were trying to do. But yeah, so in hindsight, I would have much preferred if we'd never called it that and we'd stuck to our guns and called it something else, maybe something totally innocuous because, you know, in most cases, definitely it's not porn. They're personal images. Sometimes they're doctored images as well. And that idea of revenge kind of makes it sound as though somebody's done something to deserve it in the first place. And of course, that's not the case. These are innocent victims who are being harassed in this horrible way.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm completely of two minds about it. Obviously, revenge porn is not a great description of the experience that people have, but then when you're trying to set up a service and encourage people to come to it, you've got to use language that is being used so that they know what they're doing. So yeah, I don't know, it's one of those things you say, if I went back and, you know, would I do it differently? But it's probably a 50-50 call as to which is the right or wrong way to do it, isn't it? And I think that's an issue that we face through our online safety. Is there's a language that is popular and it's not always accurate. And then there's a language which is accurate, but not always well understood. And deciding which to use, I tend to err to the popular, even though I know that online safety specialists will give me a bit of a hard time, because I think, you know, you're trying to engage the public or your users, et cetera. I think it's a better approach. But that obviously was, I mean, at the time, it was probably one of the only dedicated image-based sexual abuse revenge porn hotlines in the world. And so I could see how much interest there was around the world. People were really interested in how it was going and how successful mm-hmm. it was being. And then it does also appear to have then led to, you know, some sort of ongoing things in the space. I mean, obviously, we now have the NCII project and we have, you know, kind of tech cooperation around this issue. I mean, did you feel your work was done? If you were still there, what would you be trying to push, you know, towards, or what would you be trying to achieve as the kind of next steps?
So that's a really good question. So, you know, the RP helpline was born out of a specific need that we were seeing on the other helpline. So we were helping the children's workforce. Then we were helping both male and female victims of image-based abuse. But then I just had this niggling thing about, what about everyone else? What about everyone else that's got problems with online issues? So I'd actually, for several years, had been noodling away on this, how to provide a helpline that anybody can contact if they need to report some harmful content and what that might look like. You know, platforms have a responsibility to remove content that's against their terms, you know, their community standards, or that's inappropriate. But we know that they don't always get it right, or they might make a bad judgment. So yeah, I'd started working on this idea of the Report Harmful Content project. And so for many moons, I was sort of walking around and going to the social media companies and other platforms and kind of making a case for this thing. And I remember a very senior person at what was Facebook at the time just went, "It's a great idea. Absolutely mad, but it's a great idea, but it would never happen." And then, yeah, fast forward some time, and then they were actually one of the first partners that got on board with this idea. And then not long before I'd moved to Roblox, I was able to sort of have this fantastic round table with all of these different tech companies who were really supportive of this idea that if somebody had reported something in the right way to a platform, you know, this isn't about overriding moderators, but it's only if something actually should have been dealt with, and it, you know, that the moderators had made, you know, an incorrect decision, then this service would be able to kind of act as a mediator between the two. So they would do a bit more investigation, you know, and in a lot of cases it is just a case that somebody want something taken down, but it doesn't actually breach the platform's rules. So they wouldn't get involved in those cases, but they might provide advice to the caller on other ways that they might be able to resolve that issue as well. So it's a really holistic service. I left, they carried on. It's wonderful. And the service is going from strength to strength, as are the other helplines. So I think, you know, my biggest skill, as well as my own knowledge understanding around online safety was the fantastic people that I hired when I was in those jobs, because all of them are still there and all of them kind of took the mantle and ran with these projects. And, you know, whilst in those early days of setting up the projects, it's all about fundraising and raising awareness and, you know, getting out there and sort of promoting what you're doing. And, you know, they've now got 5 times the staff that I had, you know, millions of pounds in funding from all different sources and just going from strength to strength. That said, it's really depressing that those services are still needed and on such a big scale.
One of the things that people don't necessarily understand, I guess, is when I say 10 years ago, you know, one of the innovators in the helpline space, you know, there wasn't that many helplines around the world. There were a lot of hotlines. So there was a lot of reporting. You know, the UK clearly was considering this kind of helpline capacity. Were there other people within Europe, were there other hotlines within Europe that were pushing to do, you know, more than taking reports and, you know, kind of processing those reports through?
We were funded initially to do the Professionals Online Safety Helpline through the European Commission, and it was Safer Internet Centres were launched in all of the EU member countries. It was a new project, and the idea was exactly this: to provide both media literacy, digital literacy skills, and create resources and support, you know, the whole community, whether it's kids, parents, educators, whatever, but also to provide both a hotline and a helpline. Now, hotlines traditionally are there to deal with illegal content. That is the purpose of their work. So that could be child abuse images, or in some cases, terrorism content, those sorts of things. And so they would work, they have a slightly more regulatory role in a lot of cases, where they can issue notices to platforms to have content removed, and action can be taken if they don't act so in an appropriate time. The helplines was an add-on to that, so it was much more of the softer stuff that was, you know, awful but lawful, as we have heard it referred to before. So dealing with things like bullying, doxing, having your information shared, being impersonated online, those sorts of things. But they didn't have that, you know, there was no need for the regulatory stuff. It was much more as a support service. Most of those were children focused directly or family focused. And each country really was able to decide how they wanted to run them. There was a mix of success, I think, in different countries. So some of them just kind of were less successful in rolling out the online specific elements. So actually, you know, as things evolved, it would just be like the main children's support helpline that would just take on a little bit of extra work with it in the digital space. So it wasn't quite as advanced as the stuff that we were providing here in the UK. That project's evolved and it still runs in a sort of way. It's called the Better Internet for Kids program. And yeah, so it's great still to see that commitment at that level, really, of how important this topic is in both the education space and helplines. One of the things that was responsible for, many of you may have heard about, is called Safer Internet Day, which happens in February every year. And it is celebrated now all over the world. When we first started, it was just like a very local Europe thing. But over time, you know, we had our colleagues in New Zealand and Australia and the US and India. And you know, now it is really pretty much a global event, which is a day to share messages and raise awareness about particular topics of online safety. So,
yes, I used to enjoy Safer Internet Day, because we could always claim to be launching it, because New Zealand was the first country to see the new day as the. But then they moved the date line and they put Samoa or somewhere slightly closer, and so we can't claim to be the first in that same way anymore. You're a global platform used all around the world, and there's an obvious kind of disconnect between the way America approaches regulation and management of safety risks with its tech platforms and the way Europe does. And then, you know, Europe is a block and America is kind of the main player. And then there's other countries around the world that are obviously going in their own directions. I mean, who's getting it right? Who's actually getting the balance right in terms of developing a regulatory approach that's both enabling development and improvement and also improving online safety outcomes?
Difficult question. I don't think anyone's got it right. Let's start there. Yeah. There is so much work to be done in this space. It is really difficult, both for a platform, but also just generally for the community, I think, to know what the rules are when every country's got its own rules. It would be really great if we could see more collaboration to kind of go, right, this is the line in the sand, this is what's acceptable everywhere and what is not acceptable everywhere, and then we can build on that. We're getting closer to that, I think. there is a lot more collaboration, policymakers and governments and regulators, but there's still a really long way to go. The age-appropriate design code in the UK, I think, was a really positive move, and we are seeing that being adopted in different ways in different places. So the California Children's Code is a variation of that code, and you know, Roblox was one of the first tech companies actually to come out publicly and support that. You know, we're not scared of regulation. It's a shame we need it, but actually we'd rather work with regulators and say, hey, how can we best support each other, you know, rather than trying to fight it, is help to shape it in something that's tangible and a way that we can all adopt it. But there is so many of these different things coming in at the moment. So, you know, both New Zealand and Australia have very slightly different laws, but around sort of harmful digital content. But that's great, you know, and having partners that you can work with to resolve those issues is good. On the whole, I think they're quite clear of where the boundaries are. But what we're seeing is different regions are bringing up these kind of voluntary codes, which makes it really unclear. They're not specific, like you can do this and you can't do that. It's like, well, you as a company, you have a responsibility. You decide where the limit is. But if we don't like it, we might still find you or take action against you. And I think that's, I can understand they're trying to be helpful so that people can, you know, it's not one size fits all for you know, the law. But it also is quite unclear, and I think it's difficult for people to always get it right and make good decisions. And there's an awful lot more of these things going to be rolling out in the next year or two as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's an obvious benefit to codes as an approach in that regulation is always clunky and slow. And if governments try to define really specific regulation, it quickly gets out of date and it takes time for them to update it, whereas codes can be put in place and they can be updated more quickly. Although I do find this concept of voluntary codes that have fines with them to be slightly odd. Like, you know, it's either regulation or it's voluntary. Trying to kind of mix the two does seem a bit odd, but you know, it's the tech age and we've got to come up with new solutions to these new problems. So, you know, maybe this is the right way. Julian McGrant, the eSafety Commissioner from Australia, she talks about this need for a seatbelt moment. What do you think is the seatbelt? Have we already had the seatbelt moment? Is this the seatbelt moment? What is the seatbelt moment for online safety, do you think?
I mean, it's really difficult. I think, you know, we still hear policymakers and regulators, less so the regulators, but more the policymakers and governments, who totally don't understand the internet or how platforms work or how algorithms work or how AI works. And so they just jump on these kind of big topics and make rules and regulations about it, but without even understanding how they work or why they're necessary or, you know, and I think it's very difficult to say, oh, we're really getting there, when there's still that massive lack of understanding. Also, you know, the tech industry is so broad. We've got the video games industry, you've got social media, you've got search engines, you've got user-generated platforms like TikTok and so on, YouTube. So again, I think some areas have improved more than others. Some are catching up, some are being forced to improve and get better. So no, I don't think it's happened yet. I think it's been a little bit of like moral panic and sensationalism and people being, you know, given this kind of fear-driven narrative to do stuff. You must do stuff and this is going to be the hot topic. This is what we want you to tackle now. But it's like, while you're having to focus on that one area of harm, all this other stuff's happening over here because you can't get everything to sort of be safe at the same time. I think the other thing is there's always been this tension around privacy versus safety. And it kind of, again, it's like this seesaw of sometimes it's like, right, we don't want you to take any, you know, we don't want any information stored about users on platforms. It's your absolute right to anonymity, all of these sorts of things. Then something happens and they're like, well, what do you mean you haven't got information on this user? We want to go to the police with it or whatever. And it's like, you just told us not to, you know. And so I think those sorts of issues, again, I just feel like we move so slowly, both, you know, collectively, everyone that's involved in this. So what is interesting is, you know, on the back of, you know, all the regulation and things that are coming in, I'm seeing it speed up. So I think there is a general consciousness that we're not happy with how things have been, particularly with certain platforms and some of the issues that have come up. So I think it has kind of woken people up a little bit. And definitely the speed at which like generative AI and things like that have come, whilst, you know, I'm not the doomsayer here, and it's not, you know, for me, the stuff that we're reading in the media about it. But I think it has really shaken people a little bit, that they're like, well, there's this thing and we're definitely not in control of it, and we need to understand how it works. And so I think that this might be the start of that seatbelt moment, a little bit of like, hold on a minute, we all need to understand it, we need to get a grip on it, and put some rules and guidance around it.
That's actually a really interesting perspective, that the seatbelt moment is that point at which we kind of all collectively agree. I suppose that was the point with the seatbelt, wasn't it? Everybody collectively agreed it was a good idea.
I was going to say, one of the things for me, I think, is, yes, we don't want to just have one set of rules that's like, this is the benchmark for safety and all platforms must have it. Although I would like that to be in existence, but there'd still have to be that, you know, taking into account the platform and how it works and everything. But unfortunately, there are still particularly kind of smaller platforms emerging because that isn't in place now, where they're like, well, you know, we can't afford to have human moderators, or we can't afford this latest technology. So they are still emerging and setting up with very little in place. And so that seatbelt moment, it's not quite there.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find interesting when we talk about regulation. We talk about putting in place regulation for those players who turn up and accept it. Certainly what I've seen is that regulation affects sort of 12 companies that provide key services in this part of the world, but then thousands of these little players, they don't follow any rules, and the actual worst of the internet exists on those little players, and yet we punish those big ones. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't be held to account. I just think sometimes we really just obsess about those big players and forget those terrible ones are a click away on the internet. They're just
exactly
as close. You would have seen that Surgeon General's report in the US about social media and youth, and I guess, to be fair to the report, it was sort of hedging its bets. You know, tech is good, tech is possibly bad. But the interesting thing that came out of that, and it's kind of a growing theme that we're seeing a bit more, is the idea that somehow there's a correlation between the growth of social media and the growth of like mental health concerns for young people. Do you think those two things correlate?
No, not directly. You know, one of my dear friends, who I believe you know well as well, Professor Andy Phippin from Bournemouth University here in the UK, he's one of the kind of experts on online harms and spaces and the different things that happen in them. You know, he says you can find correlation in anything if you look hard enough. So, yes, I definitely do think it's really hard for kids growing up online. We didn't have to go through this. And I think the experiences that adults have, which might be negative, but they're very different than the ones that kids might have. So, you know, all of those things like body image, you know, the fact that bullying, you know, used to be in the playground and now it follows you home if you're having issues, you know, it continues everywhere. It's really hard to get away from it. So I can't not, you know, say, no, there's no harm to be had on the internet, because my whole career in the last 15 years has been around fixing these sorts of issues. But also, so yes, I think it does impact mental health, but it's not the biggest cause, I don't think. You know, generally, the world's in a terrible state and kids absorb that just as much as adults do, if not more. We know that COVID had a huge impact on a particular generation. Do I wish sometimes that the internet had never come out and that kids didn't go on it? Then yes, because, you know, I've seen so many times where it does have an impact. But I think using it as a kid's mental health, I think more specific issues can have an impact and they're short term. I'm not sure that I've seen evidence that it will affect long term mental health. I think it's more that, you know, they might just have these experiences that are hopefully not, you know, prolonged for too long, but that will have an impact. But hopefully, you know, with the right resolution. What we also see is the positives of being online. Again, you know, mentioning COVID, kids couldn't see each other, they weren't in school, they couldn't hang out together. So having space, safe spaces online where they could be together, hang out, talk to their families, you know, that was actually a lifeline for lots of communities in that difficult time. So that would have been a benefit to mental health. So I think there's always a bit of balance that's needed.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Young people are having conversations that wouldn't have been had about things that they wouldn't have known about in the past. And some of those things are going to weigh pretty heavily on, I mean, they weigh heavily on all of us, but they're going to weigh heavily on young people. And so you probably can't directly correlate the sort of advent of tech to these mental health impacts, but it's not because tech did it, but because it showed us the world, and that the world is a bit depressing. Let's talk about end-to-end encryption. I know this has been a big fun topic in the UK lately, because the last I looked, the online safety bill of the UK, it seems to have weaved and bounced and gone, you know, from one iteration to the next. So it wouldn't surprise me if by now this has been dropped out of it. But there's a real concern about the way the bill's trying to treat end-to-end encryption. What's your view on end-to-end encryption and its relationship with safety? Where do you think we're going with this?
This is really interesting. When I ran my previous helplines, particularly the image-based one, these conversations were sort of happening then, and law enforcement were asking for like backdoors into certain platforms. And, you know, we worked with a lot of privacy experts, and they were saying, look, if you open a backdoor, even for law enforcement, for the most, you know, real valuable reason, it opens it for everybody. And it, you know, creates risk. And actually, a lot of the images that we were tasked with removing off the internet had been hacked, stolen, you know, had ended up on the dark web because, you know, it was from insecure platforms, basically.
Yeah.
And so that always kind of sat with me, that it's like, actually, it's got to be, if it's secure, it's got to be secure for everybody. We have a right to privacy. And, you know, end-to-end encryption is not a new thing. It's been around on certain platforms for quite a long time. There has been an increase. We've seen the figures about, you know, online child abuse and the issues around that. But I don't correlate the two. And this argument that it gives people a place to hide and that there's no accountability is just not true, actually. You know, they have already been able to deal with cases involved using these platforms. So I think it's more that there's been a breakdown in communication between the providers and the people who are enforcing the rules on this discussion.
What a very political answer.
Yeah,
there's just a bit of... One of them's wrong. So, I mean... That's actually a deliberately inflammatory thing to say one's right and one's wrong. I mean, you can both be right and wrong at the same time. And I think the thing with end-to-end encryption, people talk about it'll provide places to hide. Well, there's clearly thousands of places to hide now.
Yeah.
The fact that so many people transact illegal content on these open, unencrypted platforms doesn't really tell us anything, because we just don't know what's happening on the other platforms. And we've been able to ignore them and say, well, we're getting tens of thousands of reports in the open. And the answer to that is probably, if you go look in the other spaces, you'll find the heart of the problem and the worst of it, but it hasn't been a reason to go necessarily. So look, my view is end-to-end encryption is it's going to happen. You know, everything will be encrypted eventually. And, you know, I don't feel like I've got anything to hide, but I choose encrypted services over non-encrypted services because it just makes more sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
So is everybody else. And I'm a real laggard. I'm not like the first one to try anything. So if I'm doing it, then everybody will be soon. Before AI was the only thing anyone wanted to talk about. Before AI, there was disinformation. But just before disinformation was the hot topic, the metaverse was the big thing. And everybody was interested in what Meta was thinking about the metaverse. Roblox is actually a metaverse entity, isn't it? I mean, that's how about it. Yeah.
Yeah, very much.
And so, you know, you've had metaverse experience. I mean, I've got to define the metaverse, but you've had experience in that kind of space for 10 years, 15 years at Roblox. What did you think when everybody was sort of rushing and saying metaverse is the next big thing, and then, you know, you're sitting there running safety in a metaverse-style environment?
So the first thing is, once everyone started saying metaverse, it was pretty passe for us and we didn't want to use the term metaverse anymore.
Right.
There was a huge amount of confusion led a lot by the media, as often is. So particularly parents and educators were just baffled, and they were hearing crypto and NFTs and blockchain and all of these other things. Now, that can be an element, as can VR be an element, but that's not what the metaverse is, as much as certain platforms would like to just lead that it's all about just the VR and virtual spaces. You know, how we approached what a metaverse is this truly immersive 3D experience where you take your singular identity, your avatar or whatever, through all of these different worlds, experiences, etc. And so, you know, as I've described, Roblox is, you know, it's a place where you can shop, you can hang out with your friends, you can watch a concert, you can play a game, you can pretend that you're at work, you know, you can go and pet animals, whatever it is that you want to do, all seamlessly in this space. And it also has, you know, an economy around it and all of those sorts of things. It is really a reflection of the real world in online spaces. It is not a new concept. It's something that's been around for a long time. So back to the conversations about safety. for us, it's just an extension of what we already were. So, you know, the same safety rules apply. Yes, that having that really immersive thing does bring some additional potential harms, and it just feels more real. You know, so we have to be really mindful of that and make sure that we're safeguarding against those potential issues. With the emergence of virtual reality and augmented reality, which we are seeing more and more of, and we do have some experiences on Roblox, you know, having those same rules, having those same good safety practices and tools in place is a really good thing. I think one of the things that we're have been quite strong on is about, you know, our immersive world is still within our immersive world. That's what we hear a lot of with other people who are talking about this space, is about being able to interoperability with other platforms. So you would just go from one place to another to another. And I think that's where some of the risk is, and still we need to do work, because one platform doesn't necessarily have the same safeguards as another one. So where does your duty of care end, start and end? So I'm quite happy that ours is just singular and we manage what happens on our platform.
You would have obviously seen, in terms of the kind of advance of the augmented virtual reality, the latest offering from Apple, and most people are talking about the price of it, but I mean, just the sheer capability of the thing. Have you had a look at that, and what do you kind of think of where we're at in terms of actually really genuinely kind of spending long amounts of time in augmented kind of reality environments?
So that, you know, we were having this discussion yesterday actually with our founder Dave, and he's got some really interesting thoughts on this as well. I think their focus at the moment is very much about it being kind of a work utility that you might use, you know, for having meetings and much like you would your phone, but a little bit less for entertainment, although the entertainment stuff does look pretty good. Would you, when you've got, you know, most of us have got amazing OLED TVs, great flat screen, you know, we already have this capability to watch a really immersive experience when we're watching a movie or listening to, you know, surround sound cinema and all of those sorts of things. Are you going to come home and put on a mask and wear it, and all your family do the same? Probably not, as far as we know as well. You know, historically, headsets, A, you know, recommendations were 13 plus. Also, a lot of people who've ever used them get motion sickness. They're uncomfortable. They actually get quite uncomfortable after a period of time. So I think people will use it, but I think it will be short bursts and it will be very specific uses that people will use it for. I just can't see it becoming something that we just automatically adopt the same way that we have with mobile phones.
Let's talk about 13, as in the age of 13. So 13 became this cutoff for social media, but it's clearly not your cutoff. Your product spans to and before and after that age significantly. What do you think of that model of sort of using that age of 13 as this kind of age of consent to use products?
Yeah, so I think there's a huge amount of confusion around this. So that age originally came from some US legislation called the COPPA legislation, Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which essentially says that platforms cannot request store data on minors under 13, and they cannot advertise to them for commercial purposes. So whether that's, you know, themselves contacting kids or whether that's having third-party advertisers on the platform, there are lots of rules around the caveats, like unless you have, you know, specific parental consents and things like that. But most platforms, that was just too tricky for them to do. So they just set this blanket 13 plus. That was never about the appropriateness of the platform for the age group. So sometimes you will see a chat platform, for example, that doesn't do anything else, but is just, you know, used for messaging people or whatever, would be a 13 or a 16 even, because actually they're still having to store that data. But there's nothing harmful on there that would affect an 8-year-old any differently than a 15-year-old. It is just purely about that privacy and the data collection side of things. So it's just a really arbitrary number that's then just been adopted as like the, oh, because these platforms say that, you know, you're ready to come on the platform at 13. I think that's become the narrative. So it's like now it's just this division of, oh yeah, at 13, you're old enough to go wild on the internet. You can go on all of these platforms. Therefore, it's kind of become the age that is open to people. And I think it's absolutely skewy and don't approve of it at all. And it's really confusing for parents. You know, I still hear this all the time, this narrative that you know, they just don't understand where that 13 came from. It's not that suddenly you turn 13 and you're mature enough and you can go off and you have all these amazing media literacy skills and et cetera.
I was talking to somebody who's been working in online safety a long time, and they've exited online safety, and they said, look, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of going to the same, you know, going to conferences, hearing the same things, people ticking boxes but not really making a proper difference, people avoiding their responsibilities. It's just the same thing year after year after year. You know, there's probably quite a few people out there, especially after going through this horrible period of COVID and all the kind of stress that came with it or whatever, who are pretty jaded about online safety, working in online safety. They're pretty jaded about online safety. Very long question. Apologies for that. What do you say to people who work in online safety and they've got to that point where they think we're just not making progress? What do you say to those people?
So I agree. I've been there myself. You know, it's frustrating. So there's a couple of things, really. One is, if we don't do it, who's going to? Like, we just have to keep on, but we need to. I think with the regulatory stuff that's happening globally, we will see some of that change. It's frustrating that it's taken that. I think it will force some of these things to start moving, and therefore there'll be more momentum, and so online safety will get better. You know, I work for Roblox. I've been there for nearly 5 years now, and, you know, to work for a company that is so committed to building healthy, safe spaces and for everybody to feel empowered. And, you know, that gives me hope that other platforms are also thinking that way and that they want to get on board. There's a lot of collaboration that's happening. So we've actually just been working on a project with our partners at the Digital Wellness Lab on the hypothesis that in 5 to 10 years, online spaces can be more safe and civil than the real world. What do we need to do to get there? You know, what are the policies? What's the tech innovation? What's the education that's needed for everybody to really move things forward? Because exactly to that point, nothing has happened so far. So we had all of these workshops. We had 7 workshops, different time zones, people from all over the world joining us, and experts from academia and civil society and governments and regulators. We had everybody there, all these, you know, great experts. And, you know, we started this with, this is not navel gazing. We do not want to know what you've done so far, because as far as we're concerned, none of it's worked, because we're still where we are. This is about, you know, really looking forward, really innovating. What can we do to really push us that next step? And the conversations were amazing. And so we're sort of in the process now of digesting, and we're going to be bringing out a white paper, which hopefully will provide a framework for people when they are thinking about this, of like, hey, here's some considerations or some research areas and things that hopefully might help to push forward. So don't give up. The future's bright. Yes, I think we need to innovate a lot more than we have, and that's across the board. So that's, you know, schools, who obviously have a responsibility to educate on these things. You know, it's no good just to do that once a year assembly and go, yeah, tick, we've done online safety. It just doesn't work like that. We need to embed it across all the conversations that we have. And obviously tech has responsibility, and governments as well.
Thank you. That's a very positive note to end on. Laura Higgins, Senior Director of Civility and Digital Safety at Roblox. Thank you very much.